like to introduce Frank Altman, one of our fellows, who's going to offer his two-minute big idea, as we've been doing throughout the festival. And then he will introduce our moderator, William Bell, and the session will be underway. So, Mr. Altman, please.
Thank you. I'm from Minnesota, the land of Paul Wellstone, who got elected by saying, I don't have any money, so I have to talk fast. I don't have any time, so I have to talk fast. But here's my big idea. I want to develop a social capital market in exchange for resources, both monetary and non-monetary, that can be a marketplace for many, many people who are trying to develop social entrepreneurs and social businesses. We have a huge population in this country of volunteers, people who are trying to make the world better, and they do it by giving of their time, of their intellect, and of their financial resources. But oftentimes, the way they do it is very disconnected. It's very difficult for people with resources to find the best opportunities where things can happen. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I work in the field of community and economic development. I'm part of a system of literally thousands of nonprofit and governmental organizations and other mission-driven institutions that work in areas left behind in our economy, mostly low-income communities and cities and remote rural areas and on Indian reservations and elsewhere. These organizations collectively manage billions of dollars, but oftentimes the resources that they need in order to do to fix the problems in their communities are not there. For years, going back to the Great Society and even beyond that, the federal government has been the source of most of the capital for community and economic development. And it's for decades, we've relied in this industry of community development on distributive and redistributive federal programs to fund investments in low-income communities. After billions or perhaps trillions of dollars have been invested, our problems are still here. Why? Well, I don't really know the answer, but I have a few ideas. First, our system has been a vertical system of intergovernmental transfers, primarily. The federal government distributes resources through various grant programs and governed by an ever-growing set of rules. This command system is a system that is a distribution system. It's not a market. It doesn't find where the capital can go to the highest impact activities, but rather it's a system governed by rules and intergovernmental transfers of capital. Local recipients have very little discretion about how they use the money. They must conform to a set of rules rather than to inspiration or mission. Second, the system focuses on inputs and outputs. While a product of our democratic government, it is not democratic. It is political. It is unresponsive, lumbering, and bureaucratic. Success is measured by whether the money has been spent according to the rules, not whether it gets the desired results. It doesn't respond well to changing needs. It's so 20th century. I think there's another way. Imagine a system that is democratically controlled that knits together this rich web of voluntary organizations into a mutually reinforcing network that encourages the creation of social value through social value chains where organizations can trade expertise and resources among themselves in order to get a higher outcome. This is an idea behind the social capital market. Now, here's what I mean by social capital market. Unlike traditional financial markets where all transactions are monetized, a social capital market has to be measured in both money and non-money activities. In other words, social outcomes or impacts. Another way of looking at it is that the players in the social capital market will seek out social value in addition to monetary value. We already have some evidence that the social capital marketplace is already developing. My organization, Community Reinvestment Fund, has generated nearly $100 million of investments from social investors using a market mechanism. These investors, rather than seeking the highest risk-adjusted rate of return on their investment, have opted to take a portion of their return in the form of measurable social outcomes. Foundations, which are logical players in this new social capital market, are beginning to make progress through something called mission-related investing, and foundations are beginning to look at ways that they can put their endowments to work for a double or triple bottom line. And nationally and internationally, there's a growing marketplace for triple bottom line or double bottom line investments. So what we need is a place where these investments can come together, an exchange, if you will, where capital can be and outcomes can be traded for the highest value. So that's my big idea. Now it's my pleasure now it's my pleasure to introduce William Bell, who's president and CEO of the Casey Family Programs, a national foundation that serves children, youth, and families in the child welfare system. Previously, he was executive vice president of Casey's Programs, and before that was former commissioner of the New York City Administration for Children's Services and in a number of other capacities in the area of children and child welfare. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. And thank all of you for joining us this afternoon for this conversation on public policy and support for America's children, notes to the next president. My hope is that over the next hour, our conversation will inform, enlighten, and inspire all of us in this room to take action to change the future for the vulnerable children in America. In this election year, as we consider the priorities of the nation and the next administration, we must be especially mindful of the needs of children who depend on us to be their voice, to be their advocates, and to be those who will ensure that their most basic needs are met. It is our responsibility to give them the same opportunities as other children to be able to prosper throughout their lives. And yet, today in our society, we must recognize that we're not living up to this responsibility. Far too often, we fail our children in their homes, we fail them in their schools, and we fail them on the streets of America. Far too many of our communities are struggling with the consequences of poverty, unemployment, homelessness, prison, and the incalculable loss of both talent and promise that results when violence occurs. Casey Family Programs has committed itself to using all of its resources and all of its capacity to ensure that America does not forget this segment of the population, this half million children who are in our foster care systems. The urgency of why we must address the issues and needs of this population can only be expressed when you begin to think about what the future would look like if we do nothing differently than the way we're doing it today. If we do nothing differently between now and the year 2020, 17,000 of America's children will die from child abuse and neglect. If we do nothing different than the way we're doing it today, between now and the year 2020, over 11 million more of America's children will experience foster care. If we change nothing between now and the year 2020, 7.2 million of our children will be confirmed as victims of child abuse and neglect, and over 240,000 of them will age out of foster care simply because they're too old to stay there. Though not that they're prepared to become adults, but they're too old to stay in foster care. And if we look closely at a shorter time frame and the hour that it will take us to complete this conversation, three young people will age out of foster care in America. In that same hour, eight children will be arrested for violent crimes. In that same 60-minute time frame, 35 more children will have been placed into foster care in America. 94 children will drop out of high school. 99 children will be confirmed as victims of abuse and neglect. And 714 children will be suspended from school in this hour that we're going to spend together. There's some people who will listen to that and say, this is an impossibility. We can't make those kind of changes. Well, we choose to look at it and say, it is impossible for America to be successful if we don't make those changes. We have to begin to address these issues, and therefore, I'm honored today to be joined by three very distinguished individuals who are going to serve on our panel today. We have with us Governor Bob Wise, the president of the Alliance for Excellent Education, a national policy and advocacy organization working to improve the nation's high school system so that all students, especially the 6 million at risk of dropping out, graduate prepared for post-secondary education. Governor Wise was the former governor of West Virginia and has also served as in the U.S. House of Representatives for 18 years. During his time as governor, West Virginia saw a significant increase in the number of students completing high school and entering college. Thank you, Governor Wise, for joining us. Next to Governor Wise, we're joined by Eric Coleman, who is the commissioner of Oakland County, Michigan. Commissioner Coleman is serving as president of the National Association of Counties, or NACO, which represents members from more than 2,000 of the nation's 3,066 counties. As the organization's President Commissioner Coleman has focused on foster care as one of his top priorities and has a special interest in dealing with the issues of children aging out of the foster care system. He has continuously demonstrated his commitment to ensuring that every child has access to the American dream. Thank you, Commissioner Coleman. We are also joined by Representative Jim McDermott. And Representative McDermott is serving his 10th term in the U.S. House of Representatives from the 7th Congressional District in the state of Washington, which includes Seattle, which is the home of Casey Family Programs. As a senior member of the Ways and Means Committee, Representative McDermott is chairman of the Income Security and Family Support Subcommittee. As a physician, Representative McDermott is especially interested in health care issues. His compassion shows in everything that he does for children in America, and he enthusiastically accepts his self-proclaimed role as grandfather for all of America's vulnerable children. Thank you for joining us. As we proceed with the conversation, we will present several questions to our panelists and allow time for them to respond. Following those questions, we will also have time for questions from you in the audience. And before I take my seat, I'll present the first question to Governor Wise. There are 1.2 million students from the class of 2008 who will not graduate with their peers. That will cost the nation over $300 billion in lost wages and revenues over the course of their lifetimes. What advice can you give to the next president and the next group of policymakers to reverse this devastating reality?
The advice I would give is to recognize that the single greatest moral and economic imperative have just joined. That the moral imperative that we believe that every child should have the maximum opportunity in this country, that's the moral and the civil rights imperative, is joined inextricably now with the economic and national security imperative, because those three at $300 and almost $30 billion of lost working lifetime income reflect not only loss of opportunity to those children individually, but it also reflects a great loss of opportunity to the United States. Let's think for a second. The Congress, and I would have voted for the economic stimulus package of just a few months ago that tried to pump money into the economy, but it will cost about $150 billion over the next 2 years. And yet we know that for around $5 billion, even subtracting the cost of the programs that will be necessary, we can cut the dropout rate in half. And when you cut the dropout rate in half in this country, what that will result in is $45 billion annually to the federal treasury, either in terms of increased federal taxes being paid by new wage earners or savings to the federal government. Now, I would ask the next president as well to get beyond the macro and look at the micro, because we talked about 1.2 million, but let me translate that in another term. School is not in session during the summer, obviously, but think back of any of the 180 school days that you just lived through. At any point did you see a news item that said 7,000 school children disappeared today? And yet 7,000 kids drop out of high school each and every school day in every community in our country. And we break, incidentally, if you want to go to our website, Alliance for Excellent Education, you can find all this by state as well. It's a great economic cost and it's a great personal cost. I operate under the one-third, one-third, one-third rule. One-third of our kids will not graduate from high school. Another third of our that start the ninth grade. Another third will not graduate either ready for college or the modern workplace. So at the end of the process, high school process, two out of three of our kids do not have what they need to function in a modern society. The numbers are even more stark, and I think you have some, Commissioner Coleman, as well, on foster children and what they face. And so as we look at education, we have to look at the child. But we can't look at it just in a vacuum. I happen to believe, and we work at the high school reform area, but it's a continuum. But we also have to look at the environment that a child comes from. It's not to say don't do something in education until you improve the environment. By the same token, you've got to improve education or all the improvements in the environment come to naught. It's a total package. And so what can we do? And here I'm going to put on my former hat. I usually do an opening. What I wish I had known in the last 25 years of government being an elected official, what I've learned in the last 3 years of being in the nonprofit sector and in an advocacy organization. But this is basically, but let me go back to an earlier experience. The earlier experience I have is this. There are a number of very important programs for children that are out there. And when I was governor, I called together our children's cabinet and said, how many programs do we have affecting children in the state of West Virginia? Nobody knew, so we went back and came back the next month and did an audit. We had 267 individual programs affecting children, ranging everything from juvenile justice to SCHIP to Medicaid to TANF to Pell Grants to foster children. Each one of these programs is there for a very important reason. When Senators Rockefeller and Hatch came up with the Children's Health Improvement Program in the Senate and worked together, when other senators and House members have worked together, everyone is there for an important reason. But over the years, what we've done is we've developed so many lines of categorical funding and administration that sometimes we've built too many silos and we've not been able to deliver the services to the children. And so whether you're talking about education or you're talking about health care, you're talking about foster care, you're talking about mental health counseling, I would urge that we now regroup and develop a way to better coordinate. America's Promise, and I know Alma Powell will be here later in the week, the chair of America's Promise, with its five promises to children, the Children's Defense Fund, the efforts led by Marion Wright Edelman, communities and schools, which works to put a holistic package available at the school site. We need to recognize that all of our kids come to us. And so I think I get another question later, and I'll talk about personalization that follows up on that, is to recognize that one, and final, some of the most popular words a former politician can say. In conclusion, is that we need to recognize that our children now come to us not as a package, and maybe they never have come as a package, but sometimes we've treated them as such, but at the both in education and in children's services, we need to work with them as individuals, and we need to do it in a way that's coordinated with both the educational system and the children's service program. That's the only way we maximize children's services, but it's also one of the main ways that we reduce that staggering dropout rate, and we finally bring together the moral imperative and the economic imperative. Just remember on those dropouts, we're going to desperately need them in a few years for all the jobs that we've been hearing about during the session, the Aspen session, that are out there or will be out there. We desperately need them in a few years. Right now, they desperately need us.
Thank you, Governor. Congressman McDermott, last week the House approved your Fostering Connections to Success Act with bipartisan support, and we congratulate you on a wonderful bill going through. In a broader sense, how do we get other members of Congress and the administration to think and act comprehensively about the complex issues facing children and families today?
Well, when I arrived on the campus yesterday, I walked into the first meeting, and I listened to a guy say that Congress was worthless, or he didn't run for Congress because it would lessen him. So I'm one of those lesseners. And occasionally the Congress does something right. They pick somebody who knows something about the field. I actually am a child psychiatrist and have dealt with all of the aspects of this whole problem in my professional life before I got to Congress. And when I, just to put in context what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now, from 2006 onward, and after that election, everybody thought, oh, everything's going to be all different. Well, it wasn't quite that different because we still had some impediments to getting some things done, but some of us decided that what we were going to do was put an agenda together to be ready for the next president of the United States in 2009. And in my case, I have a subcommittee that has really the safety net. I have welfare and unemployment insurance and foster kids and all the things that were set in place in 1935. Foster children legislation in this country has not been changed in a major ways in 30 years. We are still operating on a model that was thought to be acceptable 30 years ago. If you think back to where you were in 1980 and where the country was, you realize all the things that have changed in that period of time. Now, in making ready to do something and give the president some notes to start with when he starts, because if you think about what Barack Obama is going to face, it's going to be like getting...
I'm a Democrat, for heaven's sakes.
He's going to face a cannonball of a war and gas prices and food prices and climate change, and here's all little foster kids down here, right? There was an event up in Washington, D.C. recently that I participated in which an organization put up cardboard cutouts for 850 kids every single day for a week. That's how many kids come into foster care every single day in this country, 850. That's two in every congressional district across the country. And it is largely they are forgotten. People don't think about them unless they happen to know somebody who has one in their home, or they themselves have had one, or maybe might have been themselves. But most people have had no contact knowingly with a foster kid. And so getting them up on the agenda, we decided to have, we'd have some hearings. We had hearings, had people come in from all over the country, give us ideas, and we wrote a bill, which we, I'll give you a number so you can watch for it next year. That's 54, 5466, yeah. The Invest in Kids Act. I put in everything my heart could hope for at this point. But I also knew it wasn't going to get through. I'm not ignorant after being around for 20 years in the Congress. So then we picked out some pieces of it. And I worked with Jerry Weller, a Republican from Illinois. And we picked out some pieces that we thought we could get through in this legislative arena. Part of our problem is we've passed a lot of stuff out of the House and it goes over to the Senate and dies. So he and I talked about what could we put in the bill that would work. And so we took the issues, and these are really the issues that you got to think about. One is the whole question of how do you deal with the whole question of the aging out kid. Imagine yourself again at being 18. You're 18 years old. 18th birthday party, folks have it for you. And when you go up to your room, it's empty, and everything you had's in garbage bags out on the front porch. That's what happens to kids in this country. No health care, no housing, no place to live, nobody to help them get money for school, nobody to mentor them. They're out on their own. Lots and lots of the kids that are out there today are who are in homeless situation on the streets are really foster kids who've aged out and had no way to cope with their problem. They get into prostitution, they get into drugs, they get into all kinds of stuff, and the cost total for all of this on this society every year is over $1.3 billion. So we pay for it, whether we pay for it in a humane and constructive way or we pay for it on the other side in sort of cleaning up the mess that we have created by not dealing with these youngsters. So the aging out situation is one that we have to deal with. This all happened because in the old days, you weren't an adult till you were 21. But as soon as we gave the vote down to 18, all the states said, hey, they're adults. Out on the street they go. And that's what happened all across the country. Now, some states have come back from that, but it's very uneven across the country. Some have health care under their Medicaid program. Some don't. There's terrible disparities in this country in that whole regard. Now, the other thing that we felt that we had to deal with is the whole question of kinship care. We'll take a kid and put him with an absolute stranger over here and pay for it. But if we take that kid and give it to grandma, or Aunt Tilly, or whoever, we won't pay for it. Why not? Well, it was a way of doing it on the cheap. If we could get him into a family situation, we wouldn't have to pay for it. And that simply is not the best way to treat kids. If you can take a child who's in a disturbed family and put him with a family member, then you have done a much better job of stabilizing their life. And that's true also on their health care and on their school situation. All of these issues are covered in this bill that we passed out of the House the other day. It is a bill that got out unanimously. Nobody could believe that I could ever, that a liberal Democrat like me could ever pry anything out of the House with the Republicans. The only thing we got hung up on was we had to have a provision in there that said something about illegals. And I got something in there that doesn't do any harm. So it's across in the Senate now. And I spent Monday morning before I got on the plane to come out here calling department directors all over the country who have members on the Finance Committee in the Senate. And all of you can do that too. Even if you don't have a member who's on the Finance Committee, they need to be told that there's a bill over there for foster kids that needs to be moved. And it will fail because of lack of attention. It will fail because we haven't been able to keep it up above the radar screen so that people will actually see it. You can have that kind of power, and that's really why I was pleased to come down here and talk about this, because if I can get every one of you to go home and make one phone call to somebody you know in somebody's office in the United States Senate, we'll get this bill out. And when Barack Obama comes, we will have the whole thing there for him to deal with the rest of it.
Thank you, Congressman. I feel compelled to offer a disclaimer that we try to be bipartisan when we're putting together our panels. And we actually did invite several Republicans who weren't able to join us for this conversation. We're gonna come back with a question for each of the panelists that will focus on what can the people in this audience actually do to help with the situation we're talking about. But I have a question for Commissioner Coleman. You know, many counties are responsible for directly providing services to children in foster care. I think there are 11 states that have county-run child welfare systems. And unfortunately, as we look at the issues across the country, we have difficulty establishing connections, permanent connections, for many of the young people that the Congressman talked about who are aging out of foster care, and far too many of them end up in the criminal justice system, either as juveniles or as adults. What can be done to address this issue of such a high percentage of kids who were adults who were formerly in the foster care system ending up in our adult criminal justice system?
Well, let me start this way by saying, giving some stats on this. I have the latest information. 25% of our former foster kids become homeless. 56% are unemployed. 27% of the males end up in our prisons. We tend to throw our money in the wrong direction. Instead of putting the money up front to support kids that are unfortunately put into the foster care system, we're willing to spend it at the end when they are in prison. When you figure it costs $89 to over $100 a day to house a prisoner, what a terrible waste of our resources. Yet at the same time, we're all in this economic dilemma, and we're talking economics here. The best thing that we can do to prevent children from entering into the child welfare system is having strong federal programs. And I have to commend Congressman Durbin on his Kids Act of H.R. 5466. Hopefully it will pass. We were working on that, and we're pushing you and pushing everybody else, and I'm sure you'll get the support on that, especially from NACO itself. But here recently, as he talked before the McDermott-Weller bill, which is fostering connections to successful act, which is to address the issue of taking the child out of the home and placing it with somebody that they're going to pay for, as opposed to the kinship of having that child stay with a relative. These children come out, age out of the foster care system at 18. They have no skills. They have the feeling of unloved. They have no training on how to survive in the real world, how to find an apartment, how to feed themselves, how to work. They end up doing whatever is necessary to survive: prostitution, drugs, ending up in prison. Congressman McDermott's bill goes a long way.
it would extend that period from the age of 18 to 21 and giving them a stipend at the same time, allowing a time of period in which they can learn the necessary skills of survival. And that's what we're talking about. And so I commend the congressman on this issue. We tend to throw away two very important people in our lives. It's the young and the old. We will warehouse our old as well as warehouse our young. And I think the money should be placed at the beginning of the cycle as opposed to the end of the cycle.
Thank you. You know, we've talked about each of you. Thank you. Each of you have talked about money and the cost and the economics of the issue that we're talking about. In this election, we've heard so much about the economy being one of the top issues that the next president is going to have to deal with. What do you say to the people in this room and to the presidential candidates about this issue of caring for our vulnerable children and its economic impact on America? How is this, how can this be shaped to be viewed as an issue of the economy?
My organization spends a lot of time doing that because there's the moral imperative, but there's also the economic imperative as well. If we are losing $330 billion, which is a conservative estimate, $330 billion a year, $330 billion of income for each, working income for each class of dropouts. If we know, for instance, in studies that we have done, that each class of dropouts, if we could only increase the male graduation rate, males, by 5%, we would save $8 billion a year in crime-related costs. If we know, for instance, that every class of dropouts will cost, going to the Ways and Means Committee, Jim, will cost $17 billion more in additional health care costs because they have worse health outcomes. Ladies and gentlemen, we're hemorrhaging dollars right now. I can take the most fiscally conservative approach, and that is to say we have to do this for the positive return on investment, if nothing else. That's why. But it's also to recognize, and so what I would call upon the next president is to recognize something called personalization. That the importance of government, and I've heard it knocked around a little bit too, the importance of government is to take what's working. The most positive role of government is to take what's working for 500 kids here, 50,000 across 10 school districts where it's proven to work, and make it work for the 6 million at risk between grade 7 and most at risk between grade 7 and 12. And when you do that, if you cut that dropout rate in half, as I demonstrated earlier by a reputable study by reputable economists, as opposed to unreputable economists, what I demonstrated was there is actually a very positive return to the federal government. Another statistic, and in what I hate, though, is when we get into statistics versus faces, and that's why the 850 faces are so critical in the 7,000 that drop out every day. But when we get into statistics, what we need to recognize is 40 years ago when I graduated from high school. I didn't need to graduate from high school in West Virginia to get a good-paying job in the coal mines, the chemical plants, the steel mills, or to take route, I forget the route now, I think it's 79, to Detroit to work in the car factory. Right. We learned reading, the three R's, reading, writing, and the road to Detroit. that was 40 or 50 years ago. I didn't need a high school diploma. Today, I need post-secondary to get into any one of those occupations. And incidentally, 90% of the fastest-growing high-wage jobs today require post-secondary. 60% of current jobs require post-secondary. We don't have a choice, and that's why we have to couch it in these terms. And hopefully the Congress and state legislatures understand this isn't hopefully it is about the moral imperative. It's also about our economic future.
Thank you.
There's also, I think, the question that this country is struggling with right now, which is immigration. People feel badly toward immigrants, and there's a lot of unfortunate things being said. But the fact is that immigrants come because there's opportunity here to come and work and fill jobs that are not being filled by these youngsters that we're talking about who fail because we don't help them work their way through the system and figure out how to do it. If we had there are 500,000 kids in foster care today. Most of them will not make it into the workforce. They will not be real productive citizens because they haven't had the hand of a mentor or a family member or somebody to help them as they get out into the world. So those jobs then go to people who will come in and work, and we are in a real dilemma in this country because the birth rate is dropping and we're not dealing with these youngsters, and yet how are we going to have the jobs, the people to fill the jobs, particularly the high-level jobs? Right now, the United States, Microsoft, is hiring people from India, and they got a research center in British Columbia because we won't let immigrants in. Okay, Microsoft's got jobs. If we don't train our own kids, we wind up with the jobs moving to British Columbia or anywhere else. And it's a very complicated global world we live in, and these youngsters could be part of the solution for our country if we thought of them in that way.
Another way that we can look at this is vocational education. Back in the day where they had voc-ed, if a student couldn't master all of the basics, they went into vocational ed. And vocational ed gave them the opportunity for a way to learn skills, to apply those skills in the real world and make dollars. Over a period of time, it's been de-emphasized the vocational education aspect and emphasized the college aspect. Not everyone is cut out to go to college. And there's still skills that are needed that doesn't necessarily require college skills, such as working in the building industry, such as electricians, plumbers, heating and air conditioning people, the building trades. You have the needs for mechanics. Even though that the cars are becoming more electronic, you can still pick up those skills. Those same mechanics that never went to college are the same ones that are working on our cars for all of the electronics now. So the skills that they can pick up in high school would greatly enhance their situation upon graduation. If we knew that these kids were not going to be able to succeed, this is our opportunity. The other thing that we can look at is also bringing in college courses into the schools, the very basics, into the vocational ed, so it was called, I don't know what it would be called now, but in which they would be exposed to the college courses as well. Too many times we do not think a child can make it. And the reason is that they haven't been really exposed to it. Now, if we could expose them to the college courses and the college environment, who knows what might come out of that. But when you're in the foster care system, you have a major problem. Those kids are moving constantly from school to school. They might be in two or three schools within one school year. It is very hard for them to put their foot down and try to master the skills of education when they don't even have a relationship, even at the school level, not alone at home where they lay their head. So one of the issues we've got to deal with is we have to stop moving these kids from school to school within the school year and give them a firm footing of education at the early offset. That would eliminate some of the joblessness and homelessness that we have, as well as, again, we're putting the dollars forward as opposed behind us.
One comment from...
I know we're short.
Yes.
I just want to make sure we leave the impression here. We've talked about a lot of the very significant issues and problems, but we also know what works. And we know that they're positive examples and they're role models for what works, whether you're talking about schools, whether you're talking about child delivery programs. And so I would like for us all to leave here very much aware of the problem, I want us also to leave here energized, knowing that they're research-backed, always key words, practice-proven methods. Now, the role of government, whether it's local to federal, to me, is to take what works for some and make it work for all. And that's what we need to be about. And we know what works for kids. We know what we can do to maximize their opportunities. And we know what we can do to take 1.2 million dropouts and turn them into productive citizens, including a lot of foster children.
Thank you, Governor. You know, that was the exact point that I wanted to make to you before we open up for questions and thoughts from the audience. You know, we've talked a lot here about the challenges that many of our young people face. And I think it's important for us to continue to raise the challenges, because those are the things that we have to overcome. But there are a number of jurisdictions around the country that are implementing practices that are changing the lives for the young people that we're talking about, but not enough is being done. And so as we think about notes to the next president, I think it is important that all of us in this room begin to think about how do we elevate the needs and issues of this population to the level of debate and discussion that is going on around this country about what the needs are in America. We convince ourselves that we can't deal with raising a 500,000 children who are in foster care, but I guarantee you if we went around the room and asked people how successful you've been with your own children and what have you done, you would be able to tell us. Some 40 years ago, we decided that we were going to put a man on the moon, and we did it. And not only did we put a man on the moon, but we've actually gone further now to make it possible for both men and women to live in space for an extended period of time. And so if we can meet those technological challenges, then I'm sure that we as a nation can meet the challenges of raising a 500,000 vulnerable children in our community. And so we'd like to open it up for you for thoughts, comments, and questions of our panelists. But before we do that, I'd ask you to give a hand to our panelists. So there are microphones around the room. If you raise your hand where the microphones are, and if you raise your hand if you have a question or comment. And so I think we have one down front. I see a hand here, two hands down front. Okay, so they're not wireless. So if you can make your way to either side of the room, there's a microphone. And we're ready as soon as the question is ready.
Okay, I'll go ahead. I have a comment and a question for Congressman McDermott. My name is Joe Becker, and I work for Human Rights Watch. And I want to thank you for giving such attention to the challenges facing foster kids aging out of the system. They aren't a natural constituency. They don't have lobbying groups working on their behalf, and so it's really important that they have advocates like you. We recently did a study in California where we interviewed homeless youth who had all come out of the foster care system. And one of the saddest findings that we had was that the vast majority of them said that if they had a real problem, there was not a single adult that they knew that they could contact for help. I'm really pleased to know that your bills made it out of the House, and my question is, do you have some champions that you've identified on the Senate side, and what are its prospects over there?
Well, as I said, I was calling to get some outside pressure on people to at least pay attention. Actually, Senator Grassley from Iowa has been helpful in the past. Barbara Boxer from California has been helpful. There are a number of people over there who, if in the midst, you know, we got about 3 weeks before the session closes down and everybody goes home to run the national election. So we've got about a three-week window to get this thing out of the Senate. And that's the real problem, is time is closed. The window's kind of closing on us time-wise. But there, I think, are better than even chance that we'll get the bill out of there. When I started, I wasn't sure. But when I got unanimously out of the House, it made it a much better sell over on the Senate side, and I think there's a good chance. It actually has in it a provision of trying to link up kids with family members. One of the things you're talking about with not having anybody to connect with, when you take kids out of a home, you take three kids out, you put one over here, one over there, one over here, they lose contact with brothers and sisters, they lose contact with everybody. And what we've done is to put some effort in, some money into, allowing them to try and find the people in their family, their brothers and sisters and whatnot, so that they can begin to put a family together again. It is a huge problem to be out there at 18 with not knowing a single adult that you can go to and say, what the hell do I do? That question that we used to give to our mother or our father or uncle or somebody, these kids have no one.
If I could follow up in education, that problem is most pronounced with foster children, but it is rife for the most at-risk kids. We know that 25%, those who read the lowest quartile, I learned how to say that word in the last 3 years, the lowest quartile and read, lowest 25% in reading ability. We know that they're 20 times more likely to drop out. This is in the ninth grade. 70% of our kids in eighth grade, according to the only federal test, are reading below grade level. Now think about it. Now they're 29 to 30% are reading several grades below grade level. So now they hit the ninth grade where they're expected to read and comprehend and synthesize and draw meaning from text, whether it's math or whether it's English. How many of those students are going to be able to hold up their hand and say, "Teacher, I can't read"? That's why one of the single greatest reforms we could do for education, and certainly foster children, is a greater element of personalization. What do I mean? Very quickly, I mean that starting in the seventh grade, hot schools are required to have a personal graduation plan for every student. Not just a piece of paper, but one that's monitored on a regular basis. Second is that schools are restructured, and you look at successful schools and you find this pattern pretty much in place everywhere. Schools are restructured so that every child in that school has a direct relationship with an adult in that building at least once a week. Not 500 students per guidance counselor, not the poor teacher who's burdened with, who's got 120 to 150 students and can't spend time with those who need it the most, but that you structure the school such that there is one adult in that school working directly with that, with 10 to 20 students on a regular basis, other teachers reporting into that person, and so now we have a systematic and a personalized approach to that child's education.
Most of what I've heard this afternoon pertains to foster children at the time that they finish their foster care and trying to educate them starting at age 18. It seems to me that at least as big a problem, or maybe a bigger problem, is doing something to the foster care system itself so that these 18-year-old kids have some basis before they're 18 and partially lost.
Your statement is absolutely correct. Yeah. And the conversation here, while we've talked a lot about young people aging out of foster care, the conversation really is about how do we build a stronger out-of-home care system so that from day one in foster care that there is an unrelenting effort to, one, get those young people out of foster care. KC Family Programs has what we call a 2020 strategy, which is designed to influence a 50% reduction in the number of kids in foster care in America by the year 2020. And it is also designed to focus on education, employment, and mental health to make sure that every child who's in foster care absolutely needs to be there, but two, that every child who's in foster care gets the standard of treatment and standard of care that is necessary to allow them to live a productive life. And we actually believe that there's only one standard of care that we should be applying to children, vulnerable children in America, and that's the standard of your own. And it's simply put, if it's not good enough for your own child, it's not good enough for any vulnerable child in America. So we absolutely wholeheartedly support what you're saying.
In my list of notes for the president who comes in is a whole question of what you do about the workforce. That's another place where we need to really work hard. We have people who work in the foster care system, both at the federal, in the state, in the government level jobs, but we also have agency people. The bill that we put over in the Senate last week allows money from the federal government now to be used to train foster care workers in NGOs, in non-governmental organizations, because the turnover rate is huge. One of the problems for foster kids is they get a new foster care worker every year or year and a half, and they may in their lifetime in the system have six or seven foster care workers because the average length of stay is under 2 years. And it is a very tough job to do. And we pay as little as possible in the government, as usual. And so people are looking for a better job someplace, and we don't train them and give them any status and support. If you give somebody 50 cases and expect them some way or other to know what's happening to those kids, you simply are asking an impossible request of a human being. Getting them, Child Welfare League of America says 20 cases per worker. But I don't think there's a state in the United States that is anywhere near 20. There may be one or two. I might be wrong, but it is most workers are overloaded, so they don't have the contact with the kids. And so a lot of what happens that at the end of foster care started way down when the kid was 8 or 9 or 10 years old and was put in foster care in the first place.
What we have to do, foster care.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. And a lot of times kids end up in the system because of poor caseworkers not addressing the issue. As the congressman says, some of these caseworkers have 200 and 300 cases that they have to deal with. And a lot of times they don't get to do the investigation. I can give you an example of a situation that happened in my county, and the person called me about it. He was really upset. The dog, the family dog, had bit one of the kids. He had two kids, and they were young. I think one was 3 and the other was 5. And the 5-year-old went to school, and the teacher noticed that there were some marks on the kid's leg. And so, as prescribed by Michigan law, she had to notify the authorities. The authorities came out, went to the house, they talked to the parents, and the person got upset. He says, "What is this all about?" He says, "The dog bit the kid. You know, that was it." They said, "Well, we're going to have to investigate." In the meantime, they removed the two children from the house and took them and put them in another home for 3 weeks. In the meantime, they found out there was no justification, and they returned the kids. Well, there was no justification at the very beginning if the caseworker had done the study that they should have done, the investigation. So we had to find a way to prevent children from going into the system. And once they're in the system, unfortunately, we have to start putting money and care to make sure that they're getting the best service that we possibly can. If we could spend billions of dollars over in Iraq every day, you can't tell me we can't spend billions of dollars here to protect our own.
I think we have time for one last question.
Oh, okay. Feel bad. Well, Governor, this is a question for Governor Wise and possibly Commissioner Coleman. You may have some thoughts, too. Governor Wise, I know you're working with America's Promise on dropout summits at the state and local level, and you're speaking at a number of them, but given this is notes to the president, and most education policy and funding is at the state level, what specifically are the barriers to increase high school graduation, that policy barriers that the federal government should be addressing? Please comment on No Child Left Behind and what it should, changes it should make to help this.
There are two major policy barriers for the federal government and high school reform. The first is I'm not an advocate that money cures everything. It helps. But I'm not interested in spending one more dollar to make a dysfunctional system more expensive. But having said that, the federal government needs to recognize where it has made gains in early childhood and higher education, and then be willing to do the same in middle and high schools. Basically, the funding is this: airgraph. From the floor to here is what we. No, I'm sorry. Floor to here is what we spend for pre-K to Head Start grade 6, Title I. And it's $18 billion. This is federal level only. Over here is higher ed, basically Pell Grants and student assistance. It's $14 billion. I don't want one penny, incidentally, taken from this. We're seeing results here on test scores and other measures. We're obviously seeing, and we still have one of the most highly vaunted higher ed systems. So 18 and 14. What are we spending for middle school and high schools? 2.3 and 2.4, respectively. So the answer, I believe we ought to invest to get return on investment. So first of all, is the federal government to recognize it does have more an obligation at middle and high school levels, but it needs to put the dollars in a targeted way that drives systemic reform, not simply pouring more money in. Second thing, is the federal government and NCLB, it's interesting, NCLB is all about accountability, except at the end process. It does not hold you accountable for graduation rates effectively. And the result is that now states have, according to the U.S. Department of Education, at least 5 different ways to say that you did not drop out, or or to measure your graduation rates. To Secretary Spelling's credit, she has now proposed one uniform measure. But it's like we run the kids a mile race, and we assess them rigorously every tenth of a mile. That is grades 3 to 8. We do a test that is a federal requirement, and then one sometime in high school. And you're held accountable. So you assess the kids rigorously every tenth of a mile, but when it gets to graduation, you toss up the cards and say, we're not counting anymore. We don't require you to disaggregate your data, that is by ethnic group, by economic group, by disability, by English language ability, and we're not even counting how many finish. That's where, in the next version of NCLB, whatever form it is, we need to make sure that graduation has, to me, equal weight with what it is we're asking kids. If we're asking him to go through the process, then we ought to make sure that the finish line is also an ultimate goal.
Thank you, Congressman. We'd like to thank each of you for joining us. But as we think about notes to the next president, there are things that you can do beyond the questions that you didn't get a chance to ask of the panelists here. And that is, one, if each individual in this room decided that you were going to commit to finding and helping a vulnerable child in the next 6 months, and that, two, you were going to find five people that you could convince to do the same thing, and three, that you were going to take your own notes and offer those notes to the next president as to what America can do to change the future for its most vulnerable children, I believe that we can solve the situation that we're dealing with. Please join me in giving our panelists a round of applause. And thank you.